This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. If you look back at the comic films from the past 15 years, you'll see Harold Ramis' name attached to many of the classics. He co-wrote Animal House, Meatballs, Stripes, Ghostbusters, and Back to School. And he made his directorial debut with one of the smartest dumb films of the period, Caddyshack, and followed that up with National Lampoon's Vacation. In addition to writing, directing, and producing some of these films, Ramis also acted in Stripes and Ghostbusters. For his latest directing effort, Groundhog Day, Ramis has again teamed up with Bill Murray. Murray plays a self-centered TV newscaster sent to cover the annual Groundhog Day festivities in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania. He's bored with the event since he's covered it so many times before. But he gets trapped in Punxsutawney by a blizzard, and when he wakes up the next morning, it's Groundhog Day all over again. And he's forced to relive the day over and over until he gets it right. Ramis didn't write the script, and he says when he first heard the idea, he wasn't interested. But once he read the script, he signed on to direct. I asked him what it was about the script that got him.
Well, you hear a lot of high-concept ideas for movies. So this was posed to me as this is a story of a guy reliving the same day over and over again. And I thought, well, that's interesting, and that'll probably work for about 20 minutes. When I read the script, I found that it went into all these unexpected areas, and it really was about one person's enlightenment. You know, at the risk of turning off people who are just looking for a good time at the movies, you know, it's about a guy who finally learns to step off the wheel of karma, as it were.
Were you looking for a movie that dealt with enlightenment?
Well, it's been my quest all my life.
Really? You didn't find it in Caddyshack?
Personally and professionally. Caddyshack was enlightening. It was enriching, let's put it that way, but not enlightening.
Now, do you have any advice for directors interested in directing Groundhogs? Do's and don'ts.
Well, the rule I always heard was the ABCs of directing: animals, boats, and children. Stay away from all of them.
Right.
And I've worked with boats, and I've worked with children, and they were both horrible. But the groundhog was sort of the best of all of them. He only bit Bill Murray, which was okay. And he only bit him twice, which was, you know, showed remarkable restraint on the groundhog's part, I thought. And Bill didn't bite him back, which was the big surprise.
Well, there's a scene with Bill Murray driving a car that he's stolen, and the groundhog is also at the wheel with him.
Yeah.
It looks like the groundhog's driving. Do they have sort of a natural grabbing instinct?
Yeah. Does this sound like a comedy about enlightenment?
Not yet.
Not yet, no. Yes, they have a natural grasping reflex. They kind of look like beavers without the flat tails. So I think they do probably pick up and dig things with these sort of well-articulated little paws they've got. So, yeah, they learned that when they put him on the steering wheel, he would actually cling to the wheel. And as long as they gave him something to chew on, he'd stay there.
How much improv is in Groundhog?
We do a lot of improvisation by choice. I think because Bill and I are both trained improvisationally at Second City, I think we treat the shooting of the film as really the last draft of the script. It's not just wild ad lib where we throw away the script and say, well, do something funny. It's really an outgrowth of all the work we've done preparing the script, and it's the last draft. It's just not written down.
You've said that you think your talents lie in making other people's comic ideas work, and you describe yourself as an instigator. Did you say that? And if you did, how far back do you think those talents go? I mean, do you think that's kind of your original talent that you've built on?
That's pretty fair. You know, I've said it too many times. When someone asked me if I was the class clown, I said no, but I used to write for the class clown.
Right.
It's pretty accurate. I would sit there, terrified, afraid to do anything that would call attention to myself. I was a good student. I didn't want to get in trouble with my teachers. But I would sit next to the guy who was always in trouble, and I'd say, gee, it would be really funny if someone stood up and said this, wouldn't it? And he would be dumb enough to stand up and say it. So we'd get the laugh. You know, he'd get the laugh, and I'd give myself the credit for the laugh, and he'd get in trouble.
Well, reading about you, I found that the L.A. Times said you were the Clark Kent of comedy. Rodney Dangerfield said you were the Steven Spielberg of comedy. The Wall Street Journal said you were the Maxwell Perkins of comedy. Then I found another quote, I'm not sure who to attribute it to, where someone said that you were the Leon Trotsky of comedy.
I think I said that.
Oh, you said that. Which are you?
I might be one of the great second bananas of our generation. I don't know. I think I made up the Clark Kent one myself.
Oh, did you? Okay.
Yeah. I like the Clark Kent one. You know, I think part of the reason I write and don't perform so often is because I have these comedy alter egos inside that. So I look mild-mannered on the surface, and underneath there is a Bill Murray in there somewhere. There's a Rodney Dangerfield in there. There's a Chevy Chase longing to get out.
But it sounds like you're very happy to be the instigator, the guy behind the funny guy.
Yeah, it's kind of a relief in a way. When I look at what being the point man has done to some of my friends, you know, I think I can have a real life. Like, I know Bill feels very much deprived of his real life by his success.
Are you also talking about Belushi?
I was thinking of John.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think he was probably a victim of his success.
Do you feel that if you had been the front man and been a star like Belushi, that you could have gone his way too?
Easily, yeah, because I understood what was happening. It was one reason I've stayed away from an acting career is that it forces you into there's an obligatory narcissism about it. You have to worry. It's your job becomes worrying about how you look. How am I doing? How do I look? Do people like me? Am I good enough? And it becomes a constant series of rejections because naturally you're going to be rejected many more times than you're accepted as a performer, just in getting the work. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that's a healthy focus for people. It's probably better in the what we think of as the British system, where people are carefully trained as actors. It's a profession. They're able to separate their egos from the craft itself. Whereas here we really link people's, we confuse their real lives with their performing selves.
You know. Now, you joined Chicago's Second City Improv Theater Troupe. This was back in 1969. Were you interested in the theater back then?
Oh, yeah. I was interested in entertainment in all its forms from the time I was about 4 years old. I parked myself in front of our first TV set and just didn't get up till I had to go to school.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. I just watched everything, went to the movies at least one day on the weekend, sometimes twice, and those were the days of double features, even triple features with 25 cartoons. So I saw a lot of movies then and just gobbled up everything, you know.
Did you dream of being a certain actor? Or playing a certain part?
Oh, yeah. Well, at first, all the Errol Flynn roles, but also the Marx Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
I dreamed of being Harpo Marx. Mm-hmm. Someone reminded me today that Harpo Marx and I share a birthday.
Oh.
And he was like an idol to me when I was a little kid.
Did you like him just because he was so sweetly funny?
Yes, I thought he was wonderful. And the whole social orientation of the Marx Brothers, yeah. I thought was great. My father had several brothers, and I thought of my father and his brothers as the Marx Brothers. They had similar background, you know, Jewish immigrants and lower middle class, you know, thumbing their noses at the upper crust. It just seemed like a kind of populist, radical comedy for its time, you know.
And it was. Was your father and were your uncles funny?
My father is very funny, yeah. He's very witty. He struck me as Groucho. So.
Now, when you joined, did you try out to join Second City, or did they invite you to try out? How did that work?
I had already taken workshops at Second City, which is a system that's been ongoing almost from the beginning of Second City. So I knew the technique. I knew the method. I'd been on stage a little, but The audition consisted of going in on a Saturday night after the regular company had done their show and actually improvising with them in front of a full house. That was the audition.
Wow.
Get up there and be funny.
And were you?
I guess it worked. He put me in the touring company, which is where I met Brian Murray, Bill's older brother, and Joe Flaherty, who I worked with many years after at Second City and on SCTV television show. So those were very valuable years to me.
Did you want to go on to Saturday Night Live like so many of your Second City alums did? I mean, were you invited?
There was a critical time. We had several of us had gone to work for the National Lampoon in New York, and I left that show to direct something for PBS with a very good old friend of mine, Michael Schamberg, who's now a film producer. He had a documentary company called TVTV, and they were doing the first alternate video, and PBS had started to buy it, and he wanted to do the first alternate entertainment series for PBS, and he asked me to direct it. So I left this Lampoon show we were doing in New York, and after I left, Lorne Michaels came in. It was the summer of 75, and cast John Belushi and Gilda in the original Saturday Night Company. He passed over Brian and Bill and Richard Belzer, who had replaced me in the Lampoon show. But we all knew each other. Everyone knew Chevy from Lemmings. Everyone knew Dan Aykroyd from the Canadian Second City. Then we started SCTV. And I couldn't imagine, I was head writer at SCTV, I couldn't imagine jumping, you know, our little show to do Saturday Night. It didn't seem like Saturday Night needed me. Lorne wasn't asking me to produce, he was to act, he was just asking me to write. And at SCTV I was getting to do anything I wanted to. So I felt a little left out, you know, that seemed like the ship had sailed somehow and they had become a household word overnight almost. So I thought I missed the boat in a certain way, but...
How about now?
No, I don't regret it one bit. I'd done enough sketch comedy. By the time SCTV was one season old, I was already working on the screenplay for Animal House, and once I knew I had a screenwriting career, I never really looked back and got wistful about TV.
Well, I want to talk some more, but we have to take a quick break. My guest is writer, director, actor Harold Ramis. His latest movie is called Groundhog Day. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Harold Ramis, and his latest movie is called Groundhog Day. Now, was National Lampoon's Animal House in any way autobiographical?
Oh, yeah. I worked with two great writers, Douglas Kenny and Chris Miller. And what we did was we basically were paid to sit in a room, and we thought we wrote down every funny thing we could remember from college. We just sat there and totally debriefed ourselves on college. We told every story we could remember, every character, and then we went into the every apocryphal story we'd ever heard, every anecdote, and we wrote it all down, and we had characters in mind, or characters started to evolve. And it just seemed to shape up very nicely once we had the plot. All these wonderful incidents fell into place.
Well, what were some of the wonderful incidents that happened to you that ended up in the movie?
Oh, God, what's the statute of limitations on this?
I don't know.
I can't even say.
No?
No. I mean, it all got amalgamated. I mean, we would start with one person's experience. And there's a sequence where they go to visit an outlying girls' college, and they actually do. They see a newspaper headline that, Tim Matheson's character, the Otter, phones a girl who he knows was recently deceased, and her roommate comes down to break the news to him, and he manipulates her into a date. It's a really sadistic and
that was you?
Twisted scene. Part of it was me. The Chris Miller actually contributed the dead co-ed part of it.
Oh, geez.
The headline was sophomore dies in kiln explosion.
Now, were you surprised that it became such a hit that it did?
No, we knew.
You knew you were onto something?
Oh, yeah, because no one had done it before. Doug Kenny had founded the National Lampoon along with Henry Beard and a guy named Rob Hoffman, and you know, some of that Harvard arrogance was rubbing off on me at the time. I didn't go to Harvard, but here they were, fresh from creating a small publishing empire. So we began to believe that we could have a big, big effect on the established media. And no one had done it in movies. No one had given a voice to our generation. No one had represented what those college years were like. I was in college from 62 to 66, and there was no good counterculture comedy. No comedy came out of the late 60s or the peace movement or civil rights. It just wasn't funny. But we knew that there was this tremendous well of comedy from the sort of pre-Kennedy assassination college years. 63, everything stopped.
Yeah.
When Kennedy died, the fun went out of American life for at least 10 years, and sort of till Watergate got fun again.
And then we got fun again.
Yeah.
Well, there's certainly been enough Animal House clones, and it seems like Animal House, at least in the movie world, has become another word for disgusting.
Yeah, which is, you know, it's not fair.
Mm-hmm.
Because the odd thing is that people mistook the style for the content. You know, we didn't set out to do a disgusting movie. We set out to do a movie about our times, about a very important time, which had a point. I mean, it was countercultural, and that was what it was about. Everyone followed with movies that were just disgusting. So that's why I think the clones seem so thin for the most part.
You made your directorial debut with Caddyshack.
Very distinguished Caddyshack.
Bill Murray, Chevy Chase, Rodney Dangerfield. Although I have to tell you, I know so many people that say that this is their favorite movie, and these are people that have been, you know, the head of ACLU in certain cities around the country.
It's sad,
this cult favorite. Was this an idea that you thought of?
No, Brian Murray and Doug Kenny. Brian had been a caddy. In fact, Bill and Brian had worked at the same country club in Wilmette, Illinois. Bill was a greenskeeper, and Brian was a caddy. And Doug had worked in a pro shop in a country club in Chagrin Falls, Ohio. He was more of a tennis player than a golfer. And I was the poor city kid who just, you know, stood outside the fence looking in, wondering what that life was like. So it was a natural for this kind of what unfortunately became dubbed as the snobs versus slobs comedy, you know. But it was about, you know, for me it was a real, very derivative but very true to the old Marx Brothers spirit of, you know, you take the underdogs and put them in this society setting and go after Margaret Dumont and Sig Ruman.
Now, did you write Rodney Dangerfield's lines at all, or did they come spontaneously?
We wrote some. I worked with Rodney. Rodney is not an improviser. Everything must be set and very carefully set, every comma. It's almost a parody of the way he would work, but we would sit up at night and he'd say, should I say and or should I say but?
Really?
And he'd try it with and he'd try it with but, and I'd say, but sounds good, Rodney. And he, no, I think I should say and. I'd say, okay, then say and. Maybe but is better. You think but is better? So we would do that endlessly. But he has such a tremendous backlog of great jokes, and I mean, they're good. They're not just old jokes.
Yeah.
They're really good jokes.
Yeah.
So he would look through his old joke files for what might be appropriate to the script, and he'd say, you know, I used to do a joke in the 50s that might be appropriate here. and he would try it on me, and you know, half the time they worked. I'd put them right in the script.
Do you think you'll always be doing comedy?
I have ideas for films that aren't comedies. I haven't yet tested myself to see if I can maintain my interest in them for the 2 years it takes to get a film made.
What kind of ideas, though?
Oh, I have I'd like to do a historical epic, believe it or not, about the antebellum South.
Hmm.
Why?
Well, yeah, I was going to say, why, I ask.
I love reading history. I really do. I didn't when I was in school, but as an adult, I've discovered that that's where all the real stuff is, you know. I'm so fascinated by some of the things that actually happened. I've been reading a book by Howard Zinn called A People's History of the United States. It's kind of a radical view of American history. And I read a story that occurred during the slavery period that just fascinated me. And I won't say what it is, but it would make a wonderful picture.
But is there some comfort in doing comedy, which, of course, you've done so much and so well?
It's not like it's not like comedy is the safe alternative.
Exactly.
Comedy is terrible. I mean, you know, you've heard people say it, you know, dying is easy, comedy is hard. Who said that? I don't remember. But it's true. You know, comedy is nightmarish, trying to make people laugh. You walk out on that limb and it can be... talk about egg on your face.
But are you afraid that if you keep doing comedy that it will become formulaic or, you know what I mean, that you won't be able to sustain the interest in it or you'll fall back on your old jokes, your old habits?
Well, I think I reached the point where it probably was in danger of being formulaic. I mean, you know, Caddyshack 2 was probably a great alarm bell for me. Not that I was so directly involved in every stage of it, but you know, I helped launch it and worked on it to some extent, and it was such an exercise because I'd done it, and it was talk about deja vu. You know, it was we'd been there, and same with to some extent with the Ghostbusters sequel. I mean, we always asked ourselves, you know, why would we do it again? And then we ended up doing it again, and we thought we had a motivation, but. The reality is, I think the challenge is to keep finding comedies that say new things, and then there's no danger of repeating what we've done before.
What are some of the current movies that you like that are coming out now?
Well, I just cast my nominating ballot for the Academy. I vote in the director's category.
That.
Yeah, I vote in the director's category, and everyone votes in the best picture category. So
what did you put up?
My five picks.
Your five picks. Go ahead.
Are Howard's End, Crying Game, Bad Lieutenant, Husbands and Wives, and The Player.
And The Player. Interesting.
There's, you know, I thought they were all unique in some way, and they all broke new ground. And I found them all vastly entertaining.
Harold Ramis, thank you very much for joining us today. It's been fun to talk to you.
Well, thank you.
Harold Ramis directed the new film Groundhog Day, starring Bill Murray and Andy McDowell. I'm Marty Moscawen, and this is Fresh Air.